Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a new report on the Congress's most 1% friendly lawmakers and speak with one of its authors, Scott Klinger, who is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. We'll discuss the nearly 60 members of Congress who have received failing grades for feathering the nests of America's most affluent while ignoring the needs of the 99%. Then we will look into the increasing economic distress in Iran from sanctions that are driving down the value of the rial and causing street demonstrations that the Iranian government is blaming on foreign subversives. Shohrab Bahdad, professor of economics at Denison University, who previously taught economics at Tehran University, joins us. We will discuss the role of the merchants, the bazaaris, and the money changers in these growing protests against an unpopular government. Then finally, we will speak with the filmmakers of a new feature documentary, We're Not Broke. Co-directors Karen Hayes and Victoria Bruce join us to discuss their film that documents how U.S. corporations don't pay taxes and hide trillions offshore while a growing number of Americans take their frustrations to the streets, demanding corporations pay their fair share. Joining us now is Scott Klinger, who is an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and co-author of their new report, A Congressional Report Card for the 99%. He is also the Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity and a chartered financial analyst who previously worked as a security analyst and portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Klinger.
Thank you, Ian.
And you have this new report has both an honor roll that highlights those representatives in Congress and in the Senate who have done the most to narrow America's economic divide, as well as the dishonor roll. And it looks, from my look at this list that you have, that the people who are graded F, which is the lowest that you can get, all of them are Republicans, are they not?
That's right. All of the people with Fs are Republicans, but we also did something different and named the most 1% friendly Democrats and the most 99% friendly Republicans, which is a little bit different twist on the kind of scorecards that are usually done.
But in terms of the dishonor roll on the Democratic side, there's a list of dishonorable Democrats, but rather than the bottom grade F, they get a C grade, right?
That's correct.
And what's what's the gulf between C and F?
Well, what we did is we looked at these 40 issues. Some were recorded votes, and others were bills that were introduced. And we looked at who co-sponsored those bills, and we assigned a positive point for each action that favored the 99%, and took away a point for every action that favored the 1%. And at the end, we totaled up all the scores and broke them into groups, and the Republicans were in the lower grades, and the Democrats generally were in the higher grades. But one thing we were quite surprised about in doing this is that we weren't all that surprised that the Republicans were very closely united around a 1% friendly agenda, but we were a bit surprised that the Democrats were not as unified around a 99% agenda. They were more spread out.
And Scott Klinger, how does this work regionally? Because the inner city people, and particularly in the inner city representatives, and particularly in New York, where Wall Street is, aren't necessarily representing the company town. Although, you know, Senator Schumer has been quite solicitous of Wall Street, but it seems that most of the support for the 1%. Come from the South and the red states in the middle of the country, often rural and quite relatively poor. So am I correct in trying to puzzle this out?
I think that's the right way to puzzle it. But we also saw some surprising things. And one of the things we noticed was that representatives that were from areas with large universities tended to get higher grades. Even if they were in a pretty conservative state. For example, Tennessee, the state as a whole, their congressional delegation got a C-, but one of their representatives got an A+. He was the only, no one else even in the state got a, I guess one other person got a B-, but everyone else got C's, D's, and F's. So one representative there got an A+, and that we saw that kind of play out in other places as well. So You know, we had thought they were probably just pockets of insensitivity to the 99%, but we found these kind of shining examples of where there were interruptions to that that sort of blanket of 1% friendly Congress people.
So Scott Klinger, again, Associate Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and co-author of the new report, A Congressional Report Card on for the 99%. And so the divide between the 99% and the 1% is probably the enduring legacy of the Occupy movement. And I think it's pretty much into the political consciousness of the country now. But how does your study define lawmakers who friendly towards the 99% and those that are friendly towards the 1%?
Well, we looked at all of these different bills in a variety of areas, from tax policy to budget priorities, jobs and wages, housing, health care, affordable education. And we tried to identify bills that reflected either clear activity to reduce the economic divide or, conversely, activity that would represent widening the divide. So we looked at obvious things like the Bush tax cuts, votes that happened just before Congress adjourned over the summer. And, you know, probably no single piece of legislation has had more impact on the growing divide than the Bush tax cuts. Just in the last couple of weeks, we've seen Congress's research arm, the Congressional Research Service, come out with a really important new study. They looked at 65 years of tax information and tried to answer the question about whether tax cuts created jobs. And what they found was that there's no evidence over those 65 years that tax cuts for the wealthy create jobs or destroy jobs if taxes are increased. But there is a lot of evidence that the tax cuts were responsible for widening inequality. So that's the perfect kind of issue that we looked at. We looked at some more obscure things that weren't as far-reaching. One of the bills we looked at would, it's called the Call Center Worker Protection Act, and it would require companies that moved call center jobs offshore to report that to the government. And then once they did that, they would be ineligible for taxpayer-financed grants and low-income loans for a period of 5 years, because we don't want to create incentives for companies to and reward companies that shift U.S. jobs overseas. That's not going to, you know, obviously change the whole economy, but it's an important statement, and that's the other kind of bills that we looked at in our study.
And as I mentioned, all of those senators and congressmen that were graded F, about which is the bottom of the scale, the most 1% friendly, they're all Republican. But on the, I think just to I'm sure there'll be some interest in the Democrats that you graded with a C, Senator Ben Nelson, Joe Lieberman, no surprise there, Senator Kay Hagan, Senator Mark Pryor, Senator John Tester in a very close election in Montana, and Senator Jim Webb, who has resigned from the Senate. On the House side, John Barrow, Dan Boren. Of course, Dan Boren is related to vice presidential nominee Paul Ryan's wife. He's in the fracking business. He's actually in the family business there, along with Paul Ryan's wife. Then you've got Ben Chandler, Henry Queller, Joe Donnelly, Larry Kissel, Jim Matheson, Mike McIntyre, Bill Owens, Mike Ross, Timothy Walz. Nobody from California, I'm glad to say. A few from New York, but mostly from Georgia, Oklahoma, Kentucky, Texas, and Utah and North Carolina. What's the your sense then of how will this in any way? You've embargoed this till midnight tonight.
Midnight
last night. So, yeah. But your timing seems to be coinciding with the presidential debate tonight. So, is there a connection there?
Well, you know, we certainly know these issues are on people's minds, and we expect them to come up in the debate. So that is part of the reason for doing it now. We also wanted to get it out into voters' hands during this month when people are campaigning hard, and we hope that your listeners will take a look at the report and call or write their congressperson or ask them at a community event where they see them, you know, either thank them for their good grade and ask them to keep it up, or if they scored poorly, ask them how they're going to raise their grade when the report comes out next year. There's in the report at least each of the 40 bills and why it's included in the report. And online there's a spreadsheet that gives the voting record for each member of Congress, so you can look up the details.
So how will they get to, how will our listeners access your report?
They can go to our website, which is ips-dc.org, and right there on the homepage, there's a another click you can click through to the report and find all the information. It's also a really interesting interactive map that you can click on a congressional district and see the Congress the representative score and how to access their Twitter account and send them a quick message that way.
Again, I'm speaking with Scott Klinger, who is an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and co-author of their new report, A Congressional Report Card for the 99%, that looks at all the members of the Senate and the House of Representatives in terms of how much they either feather the nests of the 1% or take care of the 99%. Is there a correlation, or does it come up in your study, between campaign money and fealty towards the 1%? Or is it ideological? Do these people who, rather than take care of the 99% of their constituents, basically suck up to the billionaires?
I think it's more coincidental. We didn't do an exhaustive study of it, but we did. We have a one-page Who Invests in Inequality, and two of the representatives that got Fs in the House were funded by four of the top corporate funders of inequality, Honeywell, Koch Industries, Goldman Sachs, and ExxonMobil. And those two were Nan Hayworth from New York and Tim Scott from South Carolina. They were the only two of the 48 House members that got an F that got funding from all four of those corporations.
So what about the others? Are they Tea Party ideologues in the sense that they actually believe that you have to free up the billionaires?
You know, a lot are, and we didn't really look at it through that lens of how many were stated members of the Tea Party. You know, I'll tell you that a number of print journalists are doing stories on this right now, and we've had some interesting back and forth through the journalists. And we've actually had some of the Senate offices have tried to tell the journalists that, for example, being in favor of getting rid of the estate tax was a 99% friendly position, that it would protect families' wealth. And, you know, there's just a sense of, you know, incredulousness that people would make that case when the estate tax doesn't even begin to affect anyone who dies with less than $10 million, which is hardly, you know, it's very high up in the 1%. It's not even the threshold for the 1%. So those are the kinds of things that, you know, we see coming from some of these folks that have earned their Fs, and they're trying to put a different spin on it. But we hope that people see through that.
Well, you know, they framed that estate tax in terms of the so-called death tax. It's been thoroughly refuted. The propaganda about how the family farm is lost to big government intrusion. And there's never been a case of an estate tax causing the loss of a family farm.
Right.
So you're saying that some of these congressmen and senators are still trying to sell this idea that the estate tax has something to do with the average person as opposed to the extremely wealthy who...
That's right. It's only the very, only, you know, the number of estates that get taxed each year is measured in the thousands, not the millions or anything like that. And in fact, there was a study done specifically of small businesses and family farms, and there's only about 100 a year that would be subject to any sort of estate tax, and most of that's quite manageable. So, you know, we're talking about very, very small numbers of people and trying to get rid of a very important tax that's been around for 100 years that raises a lot of money to fund all sorts of programs that are important to working families in this country, and trying to get rid of that on the basis of these pretty much made-up arguments.
Well, tonight we're going to have a debate, of course, between a bona fide representative of the 1% running against the incumbent president, who hasn't exactly been unfriendly to Wall Street. But I think there is a difference between the two of them in terms of their understanding of fairness in this country. How about, though, and obviously your new study is, in fact, a congressional report card for the 99%, is obviously, in a way, can I describe it as a name and shaming report? I mean, it's naming and shaming, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly a piece of it. We did it in order to try and inspire people's imagination to begin to look at legislation through an inequality lens, to not just see the financial cost of it, but also to begin to see the social cost of things that our Congress is passing or on the other side, not even considering things that would reduce inequality. So we really want people to get used to thinking about the bills they're reading about in the paper, as many of them do have a very strong impact on inequality, and if that's an issue they care about, they might want to look at the issues through that lens. But the end result is that we give a grade for every sitting member of Congress, and you know the good ones are celebrated and the bad ones are told to get out of detention hall and go back and do a better job.
Well, but my question would be, are they capable of being shamed? Is there evidence that this is really the fact that you say a lot of the print reporters have been working with you today on this report that you've just released have been getting feedback from the Senate and the House? It would indicate to me perhaps that it is making them uncomfortable. Maybe shaming is working.
Well, I think it is making them uncomfortable. We also have heard from a couple of print sources that they're not going to cover the report, but that they're going to use them when they do their editorial endorsements later in October. So, you know, that's not something we had thought about or planned on, but that's an interesting use of them, and we're glad that people are thinking about the issue in that way.
So, in other words, these Congress people could in fact have this tag of how they are on the 99% meter. In terms
yeah.
of,
I mean, I think there's some that probably would wear their F as a badge of pride, you know, given who they are and who they are ideologically.
Yeah, but what about their constituents? No congressman has a constituent full of billionaires.
That's right. You know,
but how do they do it? How can you be so slavish to the billionaires and yet represent ordinary people?
I think the argument we most often hear is that they're for small government. They want to get government off their back. They don't want regulation. They don't want taxes. They don't want this. They don't want that. And so, you know, given that a lot of these bills have to do with taxes and how we spend money and regulations and support for affordable education, you know, they would ideologically be strong opponents to many of those things, if not all of them. And therefore is why I think they wear their F as a badge of honor. You know, I don't think most representatives are that way, though. I think most really do care, and I think most, you know, are rightfully concerned to be deemed not a friend to the masses, because that's who elects them. We're hoping that it causes some stir, some discussion, some discomfort, some dialogue. All those things would be good outcomes.
Well, Scott Klinger, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian. It's been my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Klinger, who is an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and co-author of their new report, A Congressional Report Card for the 99%. He is also the Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity and a chartered financial analyst who previously worked as a security analyst and portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the apparent economic distress in Iran as the sanctions appear to be biting.
So excuse me, Mr. Butter, I'm a Mr. Two, and you're giving Mr. Bad name, Mr. Like You. So I'm taking the Mr. from out in front of your name, 'cause it's Mr. Like You that puts the rest of us to shame. It's a Mr. Like.
ای فدای آن همه عطر و بوی تو هر زمان دل می کشد پر به سوی تو هر کجا پا می نهم سر فرود آرم قبله گاه من شده خاک کوی تو.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sohrab Behdad, who is a professor of economics at Denison University, Ohio. he taught at the Faculty of Economics in Tehran University from 1979 until 1983. And from 1992 to 1995, he was the chair of the Economics Department at Denison University and was president of the Middle East Economics Association and is now co-chair of the Middle East Economics Association's Committee for Human Rights and Academic Freedom. He's also been on the editorial board of the International Journal of Middle East Studies and associate economic editor of Middle East Studies Association Bulletin. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sohrab Behdad.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm very happy to be with you.
So you're obviously in touch with people in Tehran. And what is your understanding of the protests that took place largely around the central bank and around the central bazaar? It seems as though initially this was sparked by money changers, and the so-called bazaaris closed the bazaar, and they're normally assumed to be close to the regime. So what do we make of them closing the bazaar essentially in protest?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because we are not very clear whether this was the closing of bazaar was truly spontaneous and the result of the skirmishes, the little skirmishes that took place a little bit higher than the north of bazaar around Manoucheri Avenue, where there is the place for money exchangers and places, you know, offices and the people even on the street who do that. And the bazaar is so many kilometers south of it. And there are some notes that there were some tweeters going on yesterday about closing of bazaar, encouraging the bazaaris to close. It is not clear who those people were. Now, the other thing that we have to keep in mind is that the protests against in Iran has different possible targets. That is, one is Ahmadinejad, the president. The other is what is called the system, which essentially means the supreme leader. Now, this demonstration has been clearly organized against or has been moving against Ahmadinejad. Now, there is this conflict within the government itself. That is, Ahmadinejad has been under attack by those close to the supreme leader in the last few, well, it has been actually last couple of years, but intensified even last couple of weeks. And now it is not very clear whether this demonstration is so-called a democracy movement type of a relationship with the issues of high prices and things about the, you know, people's livelihood, or it is something that it could be possibly instigated by those against Ahmadinejad and for the supreme leader. It is not clear. And in fact, even if it is as such, it may turn out something that they didn't expect, because some of the, a couple of the slogans were about, most of the slogans were about the high rate of exchange and asking the government to reduce the exchange and make it into half, etc. And there was one slogan that people were shouting, and that was more, it was much wider than Ahmadinejad, and that was, leave Syria alone on its own and come and help your own people. This is the slogan against the regime, against the Khamenei and the supreme leader and the security forces. So how it is going to turn out tomorrow, we don't know. I don't know. But there is also another issue, that the movement of the security forces was relatively relaxed. Usually they are very brutal on these type of things. They don't give any chance for anyone to move. Now, Larry Johnny, who is the Speaker of the House, was supposed to give a talk today against an interview that Ahmadinejad had a couple of days ago, where he said that everybody is attacking me, then don't let me do my job. They should know better. We are under sanction. We are under pressure. And why don't you help me? And the other side, of course, is saying, well, Ahmadinejad is not doing his job, etc. So I think this is an unknown situation, and it might very well be a movement against the regime, or turn out to become like that, or it would be a prelude to pulling Ahmadinejad on the chopping block and getting rid of him, because there is some very intense confrontations within the regime.
Again, I'm speaking with Professor of Economics at Denison University, Sohrab Behdad, and we're discussing the riots or the demonstrations that took place in Tehran today near the Grand Bazaar and the area in front of the central bank. As you just mentioned, Sohrab Behdad, there is this, of course, ongoing battle between Speaker Larijani, who's apparently close to the grand, to the spiritual leader Ayatollah Khamenei, and the nominal head of the government, Ahmadinejad, who he's a lame duck, isn't he? I mean,
yes, his term is going to be finished soon. In June, there is a new election,
and I don't know how. Obviously, you have a controlled press in Iran, but. His trip to New York, they would have had to work overtime to put a positive spin on that, wouldn't they?
Yes. Well, he was actually very tired and not as, forceful and, forthcoming as he used to be in his previous trip. So it looks like he's a tired man and he's under pressure. But I have to say this, that there is a whole lot of pressure on Iranian people. Because the sanctions have really done very much harm to the livelihood and life of people. Because Iran's main income, foreign exchange revenue, is from oil. Oil production and export has declined drastically. But even more important than that is Iran is not able to move the money that it earns from selling its oil. And also, Iran has about $80 billion worth of foreign exchange, but it does not have much access to them. So the result is a shortage of foreign exchange. And the shortage of foreign exchange for Iran is quite important because it's about $70 billion worth of imports last year. Now, this year, they have to cut that. And they not only they don't have money, they cannot make the payments. Therefore, a lot of things that are imported to Iran are going to have been reduced. Now, about 80% of imports to Iran are intermediate and capital goods, essentially goods that are used in the production process, which means if those are not imported, factories will not be able to work. And if they are not able to work, not only the output is not there, but also many people are going to be unemployed, which has been going on over the last particularly over the last year as the sanctions have become harder. So if with this confrontation within the government and the pressure that it is on people, scared of a situation that's going to happen, all the wars of talk and et cetera, people have moved into converting their savings into dollars. And there is so-called, we call it a speculative movement. This speculative movement shot the foreign exchange rate. Now it is 300%, 350% of what it was last year. So that much of an increase in foreign exchange in a country that is so reliant on imports, it is going to be quite rough. So life is very rough in Iran for people, and prices are going up. Inflation is hitting everywhere. So people are very disturbed, and now this might be a situation that would spread quite quickly. So we don't know. We have to see and watch what happens.
Again, I'm speaking with Sohrab Behdad, who is a professor of economics at Denison University and previously was on the Faculty of Economics at Tehran University. And we're talking about the demonstrations today where tires were set on fire and rubbish bins were set on fire, and there were a number of arrests as crowds chanted anti-government slogans in front of the central bank and in around the shops of the central bazaar. And the bazaaris, as they're called, closed the bazaar, closed the shutters in sympathy, apparently in sympathy to the protesters, protesting, of course, the dramatic drop in the value of the real against the dollar that Sourav just mentioned. You also said earlier about how people have, in these crowds demonstrating are saying, you know, stop supporting Syria and take care of people at home. Those kind of sentiments were also expressed on the day that they celebrate in solidarity with Palestine. I can't remember what it's called, maybe Al-Quds Day.
Quds Day, right.
Yeah. Similar, I talked to a reporter that was there, one of the few Western reporters in Tehran. He told me that people were shouting, you know, why are we giving money to the Palestinians? Let's take care of Iranians. So now they're saying the same thing about Syria. That, of course, does that mean that the Ahmadinejad foreign policy is unpopular, that this kind of idea of the great Persian Empire that Ahmadinejad often refers to in a kind of, you know, megalomaniacal way, is that unpopular at home?
Well, we have to be clear here. The foreign policy is the monopoly of the supreme leader. So whatever connection is with Syria, with Lebanese Hezbollah, and any other groups that in the region or in Iraq, it is decided and promoted by the supreme leader. So Ahmadinejad and his foreign minister are at most executors of the decision of the supreme leader. On the issues of the nuclear negotiation, it is the supreme leader who is totally in charge. So Ahmadinejad is actually, with little power, especially since last year, and he has some executive power within the ministries, but when it becomes something that has to do with the major policies of the regime, as Iran they call it, Nizam, the system, anything that has to do that is coming from the supreme leader. And they are the ones who, he is the one, and through his, well, the supreme leader has a very large bureaucracy and members, and he has a representative in everywhere. So it is actually the executors and decision maker of the major policy decisions.
Well, my
including the foreign policy, excuse me.
Right. But my understanding is that apart from the supreme leader, really the most powerful man short of the supreme leader is the head of the Quds Force, General Suleiman, right?
Well, the various parts of the Revolutionary Guard, now Quds is a part of that also, are very powerful. But there are, again, of course, we don't know who is the arm of who, whether the supreme leader is the arm of the Revolutionary Guard or Revolutionary Guard is the arm of the supreme leader. But it is in unison that the two act. So whatever that is heads of the or the various heads of this Revolutionary Guard say, it is generally interpreted as a statement that is coming from the supreme leader. Otherwise, they would not say it. Or if they do and they make mistake, they have to come apologize and change their words and say, well, that interview was not correct, etc. But, those policies are with him. Now, Ahmadinejad is taking a nationalistic view for at least last two or three years, and it is quite apparent. For example, in his interview the other day, which became controversial in what he said because he was very forceful in his attack on the people who are intervening in the work of the state, and that is the presidency, etc. He never used the word Islam. He talked about Iran is very powerful, Iran will do this, Iran is the old nation, etc. But he never said Islamic countries or the power of Islam, etc., which is the language of the supreme leader. He did not use that. Clearly, he wants to separate his line as he sees he's becoming the villain in the confrontation with the supreme leader. And he might, in any time, will have a destiny that was similar to the first president of Iran, Bani Sadr, who had to run away from the country and take refuge someplace, in France, that is. he might have that fate any time before the end of his term, because it is considered that he is done and finished with. And they're waiting for the end of the term. So far, they have been the supreme leader after a couple of conflicts that they had a couple of years ago. About he was acting as a renegade, was not listening to supreme leader, and he was considered to be impeached, and some were considering that. And it was understood and it was said that the supreme leader said he would rather have him just finish his term quietly. So now whether he can finish his term quietly or not under this present circumstances is not for sure.
Well, just in closing, Sohrab Behdad, obviously we've heard a lot of speculation about a war between Israel and Iran. Even before the elections, Prime Minister Netanyahu has been quite belligerent, and he had that speech at the United Nations where he had that cartoon picture of the bomb, mm-hmm. and basically drew a red line and said in the spring, mm-hmm. Iran will cross the red line, implying that there'd be war in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, what Obama and others have obviously been trying to restrain him by saying, look, let the sanctions work. Well, our discussion indicates that the sanctions are working. So does that put Netanyahu out in the cold?
Well, Netanyahu has his own problems, of course, in the domestic arena, what is going on in Israel, and he wants to maintain the position it has. But what is interesting in this context is, very clearly now, perhaps for the first time in terms of the United States government establishment, the issue of Israeli interests, that is, Israeli government's interests, and American interests are putting against each other. That is, Obama in his recent talk said, well, I listen to or I consider what is the interest of the American people, not the noise that comes from around, and we're referring to Netanyahu. Well, this was not much the case before. And it was, nobody who dares saying such strong statements about the divergence of the two interests here. So, yeah, it is Netanyahu probably is doing that. He wants to sort of egg on the U.S. president to get into some kind of war. Or to some extent it is, if he knows what the outcome is and the U.S. is not getting into it, it's a some psychological warfare that is pressing Iran, and which unfortunately the psychological warfare works against this whole process because it has strengthened the most reactionary, the most warmongering elements of the Iranian society, which is essentially the army, the guards, and elements around it. It's very unfortunate that this comes up, because any process toward peace will weaken the government of the Islamic Republic. Any move toward war would strengthen it. And that is very unfortunate that these forces are working that way, even though they think that their interest is the other way.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Professor Sohrab Behdad.
Well, Ian, thank you very much.
And I've been speaking with Professor of Economics at Denison University, Sohrab Behdad, who taught at the Faculty of Economics at Tehran University from 1979 until 1983. From 1992 to 1995, he was chair of economics department at Denison University and was president of the Middle East Economics Association and is now co-chair of the Middle East Economics Association's Committee on Human Rights and Academic Freedom. He's also been on the editorial board of the International Journal of Middle East Studies and the associate economics editor of the Middle East Studies Association Bulletin. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking with the two filmmakers of a new film, We're Not Broke. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now are Karen Hayes and Victoria Bruce, who are the co-directors of a number of award-winning documentary films, including The Kidnapping of Ingrid Betancourt and Held Hostage in Colombia, a documentary about three American contractors captured by FARC guerrillas. And in 2010, their first book, Hostage Nation, Colombia's Guerrilla Army and the Failed War on Drugs, was published by Knopf. And their latest documentary feature just out is We're Not Broke, which documents how U.S. corporations don't pay taxes and hide trillions offshore, while a growing number of Americans take their frustrations to the streets, demanding corporations pay their fair share. Welcome to Background Briefing, Karen Hayes and Victoria Bruce.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ian. So, Karen, this feels like old home week to me, because all of the people I've been talking to over the last few years about taxes and tax avoidance are in the film. David K. Johnston, Ed Kleinbaut, here, who's out here at USC, James Henry, who, of course, did that important recent report on how much money's being squirreled away offshore, and Nick Shaxton, who's the global expert on offshore tax havens, etc. Tell me, what prompted you to start this film?
In 2010, we got into contact with the person who became our executive producer. He's the publisher of the American Interest magazine. His name's Charles Davidson. And he approached us to do something on offshore tax havens. And initially, we were thinking maybe a book, but then we proposed the idea of a film. And he said that sounded good, so we just moved ahead. And at that time in 2010, October, nobody was really talking about this issue. And we, having done films about many other subjects, nothing financial related, thought this was a fascinating topic and something that we just wanted to dive into to explore.
And Victoria, of course, this film really, I think, is at its heart is about this enormous con that's taken place on the American people, where, you know, we won't know until after the elections how many people have fallen for the con. But essentially, in spite of the evidence of what austerity has done in Greece and in the United Kingdom, the very people who brought the global economy to a near-death experience and impoverished millions of Americans and downsized millions more, yet they were rescued by the beleaguered middle-class taxpayers. And now they are telling us that everybody has to tighten their belt because of this terrible deficit problem. Everybody except the people on Wall Street who created the problem in the first place.
Well, you know, every day we're seeing Apple, highest profits ever. They have $1 trillion offshore. Exxon, biggest global company in the world. These companies that... somehow this financial disaster has not hit these multinational corporations in the U.S. at all. Why is it only on us? You know, one of the reasons is because if Apple's got $1 trillion hidden offshore, that's theoretically about $300 billion that they owe us in taxes. So, you know, we're firing teachers, and we've got these multinationals that are just really, completely taking advantage of us, and it's very, very sad. So I think people are waking up. I think what Karen said is when we started this, no one was talking about it, and now it's this huge topic. However, tonight at this little meet and greet that we're going to have, I don't see either side talking about corporations that are hiding their money, because both sides are complicit in letting the corporations get away with it.
And Karen, I guess the point here is that if corporations were paying their fair share, if the wealthy weren't able to hide their taxes abroad, as we've learned a little from Mitt Romney, although he still refuses to provide most of the tax returns, including the 2009, which people like Ed Kleinbaut and David K. Johnson have a fairly educated suspicion might include tax amnesty, which the IRS offered for all of the wealthy Americans who have Swiss bank accounts, etc. So, I mean, that's the bottom line here, isn't it? That we're not broke, and if these people coughed up their fair share, we wouldn't be having these discussions about deficits.
Right. I mean, right now there's over $1.4 trillion that multinational corporations have shifted into subsidiaries, offshore tax havens overseas. And as you mentioned, a number of wealthy individuals who are hiding money off shore as well. And so basically with our film, what we're trying to
point out is that you're right, we're not broke. If these corporations were actually forced to pay the 35% tax rate that they have enacted right now, then it wouldn't solve our entire debt or deficit, but it would certainly help contribute to not having all these cuts that are taking place right now.
So, Victoria, in tonight's, as you described, this, the meet and greet, the first presidential debate, which 50 million Americans are expected to watch, do you think there's an opening there for Obama? I know in the film you don't spare criticism towards him, but you would think that, given that this surreptitious tape emerged of Romney talking about the 47% who don't pay their taxes, and given that he, either through arrogance or because he's afraid to reveal his taxes, has refused to even follow the footsteps of his own father, who set the precedent. And furthermore, my understanding is that Mitt Romney's nominee for Secretary of Treasury is John Thain, the former head of Merrill Lynch, who Bank of America, who feature in your film, suing. You know, they're suing him. At least Bank of America shareholders are suing him because he defrauded Bank of America by downplaying the extraordinary mortgage debt of Merrill Lynch when B of A bought it.
Right, and I think that this is something that we have to. What it all really comes down to is here in Washington, the money has to be taken out of politics. I think both sides have been bought. In 2008, it was easy for Obama to say, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that and I'm going to close corporate tax loopholes, but he didn't. So he's not talking about corporate tax cheats. And Mitt Romney doesn't want to talk about individual tax cheats. So, you know, there's like all this buzz going around about taxes right now, but neither side wants to talk about it. So, you know, the idea of getting money out of politics is the only way we would solve this, because Merrill Lynch will not end up in the government if Merrill Lynch can't buy the government. So, you know, it really comes down to that.
So, Karen, when you were filming, for example, the Tea Party rallies, and there's this fervent belief on the part of the Tea Party people that we're overtaxed, and yet by international standards we're the least taxed. And in many ways, the strange thing about this election is that President Obama, for all of the vilification that's been directed towards him from the right and from the Tea Party, is actually kind of, he's almost the reincarnation of Richard Nixon in terms of his policies. In fact, Nixon would have gone for single payer and almost did, except for Watergate. I mean, the stock market's doing better than ever. The corporations are richer than ever. You know, what's their problem? You know, what was your sense of what has got these people all so bothered about something that is so completely, you know, unfactual, if that's the right word?
Yeah, well, my sense is, and through the exploration of the topic in our film and talking to our experts, basically our society has been fed this myth of that we are overtaxed for the last, I'd say, 30 plus years, that, you know, we're as individuals, we're so overtaxed as a, you know, nationally. And the reality is, compared to many other countries around the world, we are not. We're actually quite low in some cases. And I think that people have the sense of, oh, you know, the government's just taking my money and, you know, the government's so big and this and that. But actually, if you look at the services that are being provided to us, everything from the roads to the legal system to public schools, obviously some of those things still need some work, but these are things that our tax dollars are going for, and we're not overtaxed in a view of looking at countries as a whole. But for some reason, this myth has been fed to us, and everybody has bitten this off, and now they feel like, oh, government's so big, government's so bad, we have to get rid of it. But what people don't realize is they're actually shooting themselves in the foot if they do that, because a lot of the services that people end up using and depending on are things that the government is providing.
Well, Victoria, in the film you show the clip of the presidential primary debate on the Republican side, where they were asked whether they'd accept the ratio of 10 to 1 in terms of $1 in tax cuts for $10 in government services cuts. and they wouldn't even take that deal. And there's also a section in the film that indicates that in spite of the evidence to the contrary about what austerity is doing, particularly, as I mentioned, in Greece and the United Kingdom, things could get worse. The Grover Norquists of this world are working overtime.
Well, and we talk about, you know, Lee Shepherd, who's a tax attorney and journalist. She talks in our film about the fact that we're living on borrowed money. We're not seeing it get worse because we're borrowing billions and billions of dollars from China, Japan, the UK every day. So, you know, when that gets cut off, we're going to see it get a lot worse. I think that, you know, what we're seeing now are kind of the final stages. That I think the Republicans in that debate were absolutely idiotic, and my 8-year-old can do the math to know that you have to earn what you spend. And the fact that Republicans can't wrap their head around that, and even Democrats to a large extent, you know, you have to earn it. We can't be talking about tax cuts. It's like a dad coming home to his family and going, guys, we don't have money for food, so I'm going to work 4 days instead of five. You know, I mean, it's just the dumbest philosophy. And the fact that they can keep saying we need tax cuts and that's going to stimulate the economy after failed policy for 30 years is just the most ignorant thing. I can't even believe you can be a politician and make that statement and people don't just laugh you off the stage.
Again, I'm speaking with Karen Hayes and Victoria Bruce, who are the co-directors of a number of award-winning documentaries. Their latest film, just out, is We're Not Broke, which documents how U.S. corporations don't pay taxes and hide trillions offshore, while a growing number of Americans take their frustrations to the streets demanding corporations pay their fair share. And Karen, in terms of the street activists, there's some wonderful scenes. I love the scene where one of the members of the Uncut group, which is a global protest movement, confronts the shareholders at a Bank of America meeting, making them distinctly uncomfortable. And of course, it culminates in many ways with the Occupy movement in Wall Street. What was your sense of this movement? Because it's so diverse and so interesting.
Well, the movement U.S. Uncut is something that we found out about in February of 2011. They were inspired by a group in the United Kingdom called UK Uncut, who was a similar group of people protesting corporations who were not paying their fair share taxes to the United Kingdom. And so the U.S. group popped up, and we happened to get in touch first with a person down in Jackson, Mississippi. And he said, you know, I'm a 23-year-old. I've graduated from college. I'm having trouble finding a job, and I've never been an activist, and this is something I'm going to try. So he was inspired by hearing about what they were doing in the UK. And likewise, many other people around the country had heard about what the UK was doing, and they started their own U.S. Uncut chapters around the country as well. And so we began to follow them in February of 2011, and they launched very creative action protests against Bank of America, Apple, FedEx, some other companies that are paying little to no corporate income taxes to the federal government. And so then what happened is in August 2011, U.S. Uncut sort of started to lose some steam in the U.S. And then it was a month later that Occupy Wall Street started, and a lot of the U.S. Uncut people here were moving into Occupy Wall Street. And one of the people in our film, he's a small business owner, and he's in Chicago, and he said, you know, Occupy Wall Street really gave us a 24-hour forum to voice our opinions about this. And he felt like it brought so many more people into the mix. And there were a lot of different issues in Occupy, but this is one of the issues that continues.
Well, Victoria, I was particularly struck by the unlikely and certainly uncharacteristic protester, the small businessman who's having a hard time making it. And the film makes a very strong point, I think, that if our tax policies were revamped away from essentially serving the powerful and the privileged, the ones that don't pay taxes, and actually made life easier for small businesses, and conversely made the big corporations pay their fair share, we would have, isn't that the point that the small business people are the so-called job creators that everybody's talking about nowadays.
Yeah, exactly. The job creators are the mom-and-pop stores. They're your small machine shops. And, you know, these are also the people that not only contribute to our society as a whole, they contribute to their communities. They're on your kids' baseball team. You know, these are the people that make up the fabric of American society, not the billionaire CEOs of these corporations like Verizon, who are laying off employees and trying to get rid of the contract that their employees have, so while they make $4 billion profits. I mean, these aren't the kind of people that care about your community. So, you know, one of our arguments is, you know, this is about bringing everything back to the community. I mean, the more we can vote with our dollars and say, you know, enough's enough, you know, I wish there was a phone company. I wish there were computer companies that didn't cheat on their taxes, you know. But really, all of these tech companies, I wish there were drug companies who had some kind of responsibility to American society rather than, you know, gouging us for drug prices and hiding their profits offshore so they don't even pay back to our community. It's all about calling for responsibility. And I think with Occupy and everything that's happened in the last year, we have some incredible momentum. And of course, in a year, it's not going to undo 30 years of bad policy, but, you know, it's a 30-year bad relationship. It's going to take years to sort of unravel it, but people are waking up. And that's what I see now. I really see like an awakening.
So just in closing then, tell us about how our listeners around the country can see the film.
The way that people around the country can see the film is they can go to our website, which is www.werenotbrokemovie.com. And you can look at the screenings that we're having around the country and around the world. You can attend the screening. You can contact us and host your own screening of the film. We have DVDs available. We have it available on down from rental right from our site, and we have it also on iTunes.
I thank both of you for joining us here today, Karen Hayes and Victoria Bruce.
Thank you so much,
Ian,
and we love your show.
Oh, thank you. So I've just been speaking then with Karen Hayes and Victoria Bruce, who are co-directors of a number of award-winning documentary films, including The Kidnapping of Ingrid Betancourt and Held Hostage in Colombia, a documentary about three American contractors captured by FARC guerrillas in Colombia. In 2010, their first book, Hostage Nation, Colombia's Guerrilla Army and the Failed War on Drugs, was published by Knopft, and their latest documentary feature just out is We're Not Broke, which documents how U.S. corporations don't pay taxes and hide trillions offshore, while a growing number of Americans take their frustrations to the street, demanding corporations pay their fair share. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. And this program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments. And the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.